This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled Critical Business Skills, Strategy. Your lecturer is Dr. Michael A. Roberto. Dr. Roberto is the Trustee Professor of Management at Bryant University. He earned an MBA and a doctorate in Business Administration from Harvard Business School. At Bryant University, Dr. Roberto has received the Excellence in Teaching Award on 8 occasions, and his innovations in teaching with technology also have earned major awards. In addition to articles in leading professional journals, Dr. Roberto is the author of 2 books, Why Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer, Managing for Conflict and Consensus, and Know What You Don't Know, How Great Leaders Prevent Problems Before They Happen. This lecture is titled, Strategy is Making Choices.
Imagine that you are working in or leading a very successful company. You've been featured in leading newspapers and magazines. They herald your innovative products and services. Your investors are enjoying attractive returns. You're producing strong earnings, and you have competitive advantage over your rivals. I have a harsh truth to share with you. You're unlikely to be on top a decade from now. It's very difficult to sustain competitive advantage. It's hard to stay on top. That's what the evidence shows when we look at companies in a wide variety of industries. In fact, the Kauffman Foundation did an interesting analysis several years ago of the Fortune 500. Fortune magazine each year, starting back in the 1950s, produces a list of the 500 largest firms by revenue. Now, what the Kauffman Foundation did is look at how many of those firms remain on the list as time transpires. So they looked at the original list produced in 1955 and asked how many firms remained on the list 30 years later. Well, 3 decades after the original list was published, we had about 250 of the original 500 firms still among the 500 largest firms in the country. In other words, half of the firms no longer on the list. But then the Kauffman Foundation looked at firms that were on the list in 1995 and looked ahead. How quickly did firms fall off the list in the last couple of decades? Interestingly, they found that it took less than 15 years to get to a point where there were only 250 survivors on the list. In other words, the attrition rate had increased considerably. Put another way, they examined the turnover year by year on the Fortune 500 list. And what they found is while there have been some fluctuations over time, there's been overall a trend, a steady increase in turnover over the last few decades among these leading companies. It's really hard to stay on top. You know, some years ago, Andy Grove, the longtime CEO at Intel, a leading microprocessor company, he wrote a book in which he talked about the notion that only the paranoid survive. He said, as a leader, you have to always be ready to confront new competitive threats. and be ready to scan your environment and spot the new emerging rival that might knock you off. If you're not paranoid, you won't stay on top. Let's take a look at what's been happening in just a few industries in recent years. In the movie rental business, Blockbuster used to dominate, and Netflix toppled them. In music, we used to go to stores like Tower Records to purchase CDs or even albums many years ago. Today, young people stream music on a service called Spotify. Most of us, when we're thinking about traveling to another city, we think about getting a hotel room. And yet many people today are using a service called Airbnb, and they're finding a room or an apartment that someone owns and is willing to rent for a short period of time to them in that city. And what about when you're traveling in a city and you need to get from one place to the other and you hop in that yellow cab? Well, today, many people are using a service called Uber. Controversial, but so far, very successful. Only the paranoid survive. In each of these industries, we've seen a disruptive threat come and emerge and knock off or at least threaten the incumbent players who were so successful some years ago. In this course, we'll be trying to understand how, as a new entrant, as an entrepreneur, how do you plot a strategy to knock off the top players in your industry? But we'll also be looking at the perspective of the incumbent firm. If you're on top and you have competitive advantage, how do you sustain it? How do you avoid being Netflixed? How do you avoid becoming your industry's Blockbuster? Strategy. That's the topic of this course. How do you define strategy? What does it mean to talk about business strategy? Well, several years ago, A.G. Lafley, the CEO of Procter & Gamble, collaborated with the University of Toronto's business school dean, Roger Martin. They wrote a book called Playing to Win, and they defined strategy. They argued that strategy is all about making choices, choices about where and how you will compete. And that really involves three things. What will you as a company do? And what will you not do? And how will you create advantage over the competition? It's as simple as that. And yet at the same time, so challenging to actually formulate and execute. Why is it important to have a strategy, to be crystal clear about it? They argued that it's important because resources are limited. They're scarce. You can't do everything. And so you have to be very clear about how you're going to use your resources in the most efficient way possible to serve the customers you intend to serve and serve better than anyone else in your business. Now, where did the field of business strategy emerge from? How did it originate? Well, really, you go back centuries to military strategy to understand the concept, right? You have an ancient Chinese military treatise by Sun Tzu called The Art of War, in which he talked about strategy from a military perspective. Many in the field of business have looked to that text and begun to use it to formulate ideas on how companies can build and sustain competitive advantage. How do they beat their quote-unquote enemies, their competitors? Strategy in the business context is really only a few decades old. We can go back to the 1950s and 60s at leading business schools such as Wharton and Harvard, where you began to see people talking about the idea of a competitive strategy. And in fact, interestingly, it was a great business historian who wrote extensively on the topic and began to grow the field. Alfred Chandler was a business historian, and he wrote a classic book in the early 1960s. His thesis, Strategy Drives Structure in Large Organizations. He studied the history of some of America's great corporations of the 20th century. And he noted that as those firms changed their strategies, they also had to change their organizational structure, their systems, and their processes. And he argued, therefore, that strategy really drove structure in the way firms operated. But then in 1970, Joseph Bauer at the Harvard Business School turned that argument on its head. He didn't disagree with Chandler, but he argued that in some companies, structure can also drive strategy. The choices you make about the systems and the organizational structure and the processes and the measurements and reward systems, well, those choices can drive where the firm might go in the future because they drive the kind of ideas that bubble up from below and get to top management about new products and services that they might offer. The modern field of strategy was really initiated by Ken Andrews and his colleagues at Harvard Business School. And they argued that strategy was a pattern of choices that revealed the purpose and goals of an organization. Later, we began to see the influence of industrial organization economics on the field of strategy. Michael Porter was one of those early economists who began to fuse ideas from economics with ideas from management. And he began to introduce other young scholars into the field. And they began to shape our ideas around how we formulate effective strategies, how we build competitive advantage, and how we sustain it. So what's the fundamental question we're going to try to answer in this course? I would argue it's very simple. It's why do some firms perform better than others? To answer this question, we have to look at two factors, and they become a bit more complex. We have to look at industry attractiveness and competitive advantage. Industry attractiveness. Some industries are more profitable than others. In those environments, there are more opportunities for more companies to make healthy returns. Other industries, it's really difficult for firms to make money. So one part of explaining a firm's performance is understanding the environment in which they compete. But we also then have to understand how they compete against their rivals. And do they have advantage over their rivals? Are you able to generate returns above the industry average? That's what we mean by competitive advantage. And can you do that year after year? Now, there are two key questions related to competitive advantage. First, how do you establish that distinctive competitive position and create that advantage over your rivals? But then, the second part, in a way, is much more challenging. How do you sustain that advantage against a variety of external and internal threats? We're in a world where information is readily available. It moves very quickly, and we can get on the internet and learn about our competitors so easily. We have consultants out there helping us benchmark against the competition. What that means is if you've proven that you have a successful product or service, if your customers are happy and your investors are generating attractive returns, guess what? Others are going to try to imitate you. They're going to try to find what you're doing and find a little bit better way of doing it. And they won't stop. Others will try as well, and people will also offer alternative products and services, slightly different than your own, that might attract some customers. People are coming after you. They're trying to imitate and undermine your business. And so understanding how to sustain that advantage is crucial when we talk about business strategy. Now, there are two views of strategic planning. Porter's view is that strategic planning is a crucial process in organizations. He argues for the importance of having an explicit process for formulating strategies, for understanding what the goals are of the corporation and how you intend to achieve them. But some have been much more skeptical and critical of the idea of strategic planning in organizations. Russell Ackoff has a wonderful quote that describes his view and his cynicism about corporate strategic planning. He says, "Most corporate planning is like a ritual rain dance. It has no effect on the weather that follows, but it makes those who engage in it feel that they are in control." Now, it's important to note here that Ackoff is criticizing the strategic planning process in many companies, and I would agree with him. Those processes, especially in large organizations, tend to be very bureaucratic and cumbersome. They take a lot of time, and they actually aren't really about formulating strategy. What happens in the strategic planning process in many firms? Well, there are lots of arguments about exactly what the financial target should be. What should we be trying to achieve? What market share will we have next year? What earnings will we generate? How much revenue should we set out to achieve? But that's not strategic planning. That's really budgeting or the programming of a strategy. Strategy formulation is about making tough choices about how to compete and where to compete. And unfortunately, Ackoff is right. In many corporate strategic planning processes, they don't actually talk about making those tough choices. They argue over financial targets and budgets, and that's not strategy. Some have also criticized the field of strategy by arguing that it's simply not appropriate to talk about establishing and sustaining competitive advantage in today's turbulent environment. Rita McGrath at Columbia has argued that competitive advantage is transient. It's not something you can sustain. It's simply too difficult, she says, for firms to establish an advantage and sustain it over a long period of time. In other words, she says, you have to adapt constantly. You have to manage a pipeline of initiatives, not one set strategy. You have to experiment. You have to iterate. You have to learn. Adapting is what great firms do, not plotting a distinctive position and trying to sustain it. Now, Roger Martin from the University of Toronto, he disagrees with McGrath. He says, don't confuse strategy with strategic planning processes. Yes, you have to adapt and iterate, but you have to begin with a clear set of choices. You have to know what direction you're headed in. Now, from there, you can adapt. But managers, he says, sometimes embrace this adaptive view because they don't want to make hard and perhaps uncomfortable choices. But a great strategist makes those tough choices. And they know where they're headed. Now, they're open to adapting, but they start with a clear sense of direction. Now, Martin and McGrath, they actually don't disagree as much as some have noted that they do. If you actually look at what they're saying, they both fundamentally agree that strategy ultimately is about making choices about what to do and what not to do. And Martin would agree with McGrath that competitive advantage is more fleeting today than it was decades ago. It's harder to stay on top. He just thinks we can't start with a view that you're constantly adapting. You should start with a view that says, here is the clear direction I intend to go in. But then I'm going to listen to the market and to the customer. And I'm going to scan the competition and be ready to flex that strategy appropriately. Now you might ask, can I go into a company and can I find a document that says, here's how Dell intends to compete in the computer market? Or here's how Ford Motor Company intends to compete in the automobile market? Is the strategy written down somewhere? And can I find it, read it, and understand it? In other words, is strategy formulation always explicit, conscious, and purposeful? Did Michael Dell have it all figured out in his dorm room when he began to enter the computer market as a young man and dropped out of college to build his company? Did each of these entrepreneurs that we might look at in the course, did they all have it figured out in advance? Did Sam Walton know exactly where he was headed when he launched Walmart stores? I would argue that in many cases, they did not. Yes, we can find some entrepreneurs who had a business plan, who wrote down exactly what they intended to do, and they executed it. But in most cases, we see a lot of adaptation and change, and not everything was thought through in advance. You know, James Brian Quinn of Dartmouth once wrote that he went out and studied a large automobile manufacturer, and he talked to a senior executive there who said to him, when I was younger, I always conceived of a room where all these strategic concepts were worked out for the whole company. Later, I didn't find any such room. The strategy may not even exist in the mind of one man. I certainly don't know where it's written down. It's simply transmitted in the series of decisions made. I think you'll find that in a lot of companies, that you can't actually find the strategy written down. You may find a strategic plan, but again, that looks more like a budget and a set of targets, not a clear description of what we will do, what we will not do, and how we will compete. In other words, what we can argue here is that sometimes strategy is very deliberate. Sometimes we know exactly where we're headed, and we've got everyone executing that strategy. Sometimes, if you look today at where a firm is, you actually realize that the strategy emerged and evolved over time. In fact, some of the ideas may have bubbled up from below, not been generated in the executive suites. Some strategies are clear at the outset, and others go through many iterations. It's not right or wrong to pursue a deliberate strategy. It's not right or wrong to have emergent strategy. It's simply the reality that sometimes strategy formulation is very explicit and purposeful and conscious, and sometimes it's much more evolutionary. It's important to think about strategy as a pattern in a stream of decisions and actions, something that unfolds over time. It's not an event, but a process. Now, throughout the course, we'll actually look at two levels of strategy. In the first series of lectures, we'll be talking about business unit strategy. We'll be looking at a particular company and how it tries to beat its rivals in a particular product market, how to compete to win. But then we'll also, later in the course, beginning with a case study about Disney, be looking at the concept of corporate strategy. Here we'll be looking at what we call multi-business unit corporations, diversified companies that operate in a variety of product markets. And we'll be looking at the choices being made at the corporate office, not the level of the business unit. We'll be asking, where did they choose to compete? Why did Disney choose to compete in theme parks and movies and retail stores and consumer products? Right? In the early part of the course, it's all about how to compete. How does the theme park business defeat its rivals? On the corporate strategy question, it's why that portfolio of businesses all under one roof? Martin and Laffley say, as you plot this strategy, you really have to ask yourself five key questions. What's your winning aspiration? What are you trying to achieve? Right? What's the vision here? Number two, where will you play? In what product markets? In what segments of those markets? In what geographies? And what's your target market? What customer are you trying to serve? Third, how are you going to win? What is it that you're going to do that's going to give you an advantage over the competition? Fundamentally, that's going to make you different. And then the last two questions are about how you're going to get there. The fourth question they ask is, what capabilities must be in place? What's it going to take to execute this strategy? A strategy that's just a great idea in the heads of men and women at the top of a corporation is not going to lead to high performance. You have to have the processes, the systems, and the capabilities to get there. And so the fifth question is, what management systems are required to implement this strategy? How will you measure performance? What kind of technological systems will you have? How are you going to monitor and control different parts of the organization? Those management systems are crucial to getting things done. Ultimately, the winner in the marketplace is not the one with the best ideas or even necessarily the best product. It's the one who can plot that strategy and then implement it very efficiently and in a timely manner, because markets move fast. And if you can't act quickly and execute that strategy in a timely fashion, you won't win. Now I want to turn to four key facts about competition that will set the stage for our analysis of competitive environments and of the companies that are trying to win in those environments as we move through the course. Here are the four facts. The first, industries vary widely in their profitability. This is a really important point. You know, Warren Buffett once said, when an industry with a reputation for tough economics meets a manager with a reputation for excellent performance, it's usually the industry that keeps its reputation intact. In other words, if you're in a really tough business, it's going to be difficult to make money no matter how smart the management team is. And even if you think you have a great strategy, because frankly, for many years, that business has been one where the fundamental economic forces are causing profitability to be low. So industries vary widely in their profitability. In fact, some studies show that the median return on invested capital across all industries is probably in the low teens, maybe 12 to 14%. But the distribution, well, it's really interesting. There are some industries that over time generate virtually no returns. That's not one company. That's all companies in the industry are looking at cumulative profit of virtually zero. On the other hand, we can find some industries where they're generating incredible returns on invested capital year after year. So this first fact is really important. Industries vary widely in their profitability. And the second related fact is that the industry you're in matters a great deal. What does that mean? That means sometimes there are forces beyond your control driving your profitability. So if you're in the newspaper business today, as the web has grown and as the business has fundamentally transformed, well, no matter how smart your strategy and how capable your management team, your profitability is being driven in large part by greater forces beyond your firm at the industry level in your competitive environment. So industry matters a great deal. There are often things beyond your company strategy that will drive profitability. The third key fact, competitive advantage certainly may be fleeting, and we've argued that it's really hard to stay on top. If we look at a ranking of the top firms in an industry, and by top, I don't mean the highest market share, I mean the highest profitability. Well, if you look at that today, and then look at it 5 years from now, the list may look quite different, and the leader may very well not be the leader any longer. But what about industry structure? If we look at which industries are really profitable today, and then look 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, we see the industry structure tends to be much more stable. The high profit industries tend to be high profit industries over time, and the low profit industries, they don't tend to turn it around very quickly. And the structure, how concentrated the industry is, in other words, is the industry one where a few firms dominate or not, that structure tends to be more stable than competitive advantage. Competitive advantage, that can change really quickly. And finally, the fourth fact, industry structure varies widely around the world. You don't have situations where industries look identical in country after country. Yes, we live in a more global world, and yet there are profound differences. So we see some industries that look very fragmented in one country and highly consolidated in others. So be careful when people talk about a global industry. Yes, global trade occurs, but industries and competitive environments can look very different in different parts of the world for a variety of reasons, stretching from consumer tastes and culture to government regulation and institutions and even forms of government. Now, let's take a look at an example to understand these two drivers of profitability, industry structure and competitive advantage. If we looked at the financials for two companies, we'd see something interesting. Let's take Pfizer, a pharmaceutical company, and Alaska Air, an airline company. In 2013, the return on assets for Pfizer, 12.8%. For Alaska Air, 8.7%. Can we conclude from that Pfizer is a better managed firm than Alaska Air? Be careful. You cannot. You can't just look at the absolute financial returns for these two companies. Why? Pharmaceuticals is a high profit business. Airlines, a low profit industry. So if you actually look more deeply, what you'd find is that Alaska Air is outperforming rivals within its industry. That's the key comparison you want to make. Alaska Air has competitive advantage. No, it's not as profitable as Pfizer, but it's in a much tougher environment. It's like a football team playing in a much tougher division. And that's what we have to remember. We're looking for companies that generate excess returns relative to the industry average. That's competitive advantage. So two fundamental drivers of superior long-run returns on investment. An attractive industry structure, an environment where the forces are such that profits are there to be made, and competitive advantage. Can we beat our rivals? Can we have a distinctive competitive advantage, a position that we can defend? Now, this is not to say that economics and financial returns are the be-all and end-all for companies. Yes, we have other goals as a company. We want to serve our customers and have an engaged workforce. We want to do things that preserve and protect our environment. There may be other goals, but if we don't make money, it's hard to achieve those other goals. And so we will be talking about financial returns throughout the course. Now, one other note about industries that's really important. As we look across industries, we also see that in some industries, the leader in one year is much more likely to stay on top than in other industries. What do I mean by that? In other words, competitive advantage is fleeting, but it's more fleeting in some industries than others. If you're in semiconductors or computers or electronic components, fast-moving technological industries, well, the chances that someone who's on top today will be on top 5 years from now are much lower than if you're in a more mature, low-tech business, say like beverages or cigarettes or paper mills. So there's real differences in the persistence of high profits in certain industries. We have to be aware of that. Are we in a turbulent environment or a more stable environment? And that will dictate how quickly we have to be ready to adapt our strategy. Remember what Martin and McGrath were arguing about. You know, how important is it to adapt, to evolve, to iterate, to experiment? Well, in certain industries, it's much more important to do that because it's much harder to stay on top than in others. This is not to say that any firm should become complacent. Everybody has to be scanning their competitive environment, looking for the next new threat. We're going to give you some tools in this course for how to do just that. Now, I may have made some of you think, my gosh, I'm in a really tough business. I'm in one of those industries that the professor mentioned are very low profit and have been for many years. Does that mean I should just throw up my arms and go home? Do I need to find another job or exit this industry? You don't. In fact, you can make money in lousy industries. Let's take the supermarket business. It's not exactly a high earnings business. Many firms fight to scrape by to generate very thin, low single digit returns on assets. So it's a tough industry, but does that mean everyone is facing the same predicament? Not at all. If we look at major competitors in the business, we still see variation in returns. Whole Foods Market in 2012 generated an 8% return on assets. Kroger, 2.6%. Super Value, it lost a lot of money. It was in deep trouble. So even though the industry as a whole is generating thin margins, we see wide variation across major competitors. What does this tell us? Whole Foods has found a way to build a strong competitive advantage in an otherwise structurally unattractive business. Well, that's really neat. And as we go through the course, we'll want to look at some companies who have done just that. Because we can learn a lot more about strategy by studying companies in really tough businesses and understanding how they achieved a distinctive position and won than we can by looking at companies where lots of other players are generating healthy earnings as well. In other words, let's go to the extreme, to the tough businesses, and let's find the winners. Now, we won't only do that, but we will do that in a number of cases because it will help us. But remember, it's hard to stay on top. The winners today are not likely to be the winners a decade from now. So we'll use some examples of successful companies throughout the course. But I'm not at all promising they will be successful 5 or 10 years from now. In fact, I'm predicting they won't be. So we have to be careful about the lessons we draw and about assuming that companies that are successful today can continue that record of success. So what's coming next in the course? We're going to dig into a framework for how to analyze an industry and understand its profitability. We've noted that there are these big differences between certain businesses, that some industries are more profitable than others, but we haven't explained why that is. And we need to do that. And importantly, we're going to help introduce a framework through case studies of several industries that help us explain why some industries are very high profit and others are not. That framework will be simple yet powerful, and we'll have you practicing that framework and applying it within just one lecture. And it will have more uses than just understanding why some industries are more profitable than others. The framework will help us formulate strategy. Why? Because it will help us identify threats and opportunities in our environment. It will help us understand what the barriers are to making good earnings. And it will help us think about how we might position our firm within a segment of a business where maybe there's more money to be made, or how we can buttress our firm against some of those really prevailing headwinds that could threaten us. And that's important. So you have an assignment. At the end of each lecture, in fact, in the course, I'm going to give you a small assignment. In order to really learn these ideas, you need to practice them. Learning by doing is more powerful than just listening to what I have to say. So I'd like you to take the ideas and apply them at the end of each lecture. A few moments to listen, to integrate and synthesize what you've heard, and then go out and look at some case studies and try to apply the ideas. So before the next lecture, consider two industries, the airline business and pharmaceuticals, and ask yourself the following question. Why might it be that airlines have been so unprofitable over many, many years? And why is the pharmaceutical business so incredibly profitable, and it has been for decades? You don't know yet how to answer that question, but you can begin to tackle that question, and in the lectures to come, we'll give you the frameworks and concepts to help you distinguish industries that look like airlines from those that look like pharmaceuticals. We look forward to some great discussions ahead.
This lecture is titled, How Apple Raises Competitive Barriers.
Richard Branson, the British entrepreneur and successful founder of the Virgin Group, once joked that it's rather easy to become a millionaire. How do you do it? You start as a billionaire, and then you go enter the airline business. Warren Buffett has actually analyzed the airline industry. He added all the profits and losses of the various airlines that have competed in the United States over the last century, and he got a negative number. The industry as a whole has lost money for 100 years. He too joked about the industry. He said it would have been the reasonable financial, if not moral, move to simply shoot down the Wright brothers on that day a century ago when they got an airplane into the sky. If you actually look back at the airline industry in the United States in the early 1980s and peruse the names of the brands, you notice that many of them are gone. In fact, of the top 15 airlines, all but one have either gone bankrupt or been acquired since that time. Which one has stood out? Southwest Airlines. It not only still exists as an independent company, but it's been profitable every year for 4 decades. The airline industry represents one of the lowest profit industries that we see. Now, of course, as you recall from the prior lecture, there are some industries that make a lot of money as a whole. Pharmaceuticals, chewing gum, carbonated soft drinks, distilled spirits. There are others, like the restaurant business, personal computers, and airlines, that are very low in profitability on a consistent basis. What explains the difference? Well, the key is that you cannot find one factor that explains the differences in industry profitability. Michael Porter's seminal work on the five forces that shape strategy offered us a comprehensive framework for helping us understand the differences in profitability across industries. Now, Michael first published his work in the Harvard Business Review in the late 1970s, and his framework, the five forces, became one of the most widely used and, frankly, misused management frameworks in subsequent decades. The five forces, what are they? Porter started by looking at barriers to entry, and he argued that if you have high barriers to entry, it improves the profitability of your industry. In other words, can you build a moat around your castle? Can you keep new entrepreneurs and new entrants from coming in and grabbing a share of your profits? Some industries have very high barriers, others very low. He then turned to the question of the threat of substitutes. What's a substitute? It's an alternative product or service that fulfills the same basic human need. It's not a direct rival. It's a very different product or service, but it can be a replacement for the product or service that you're selling. What's an example? Let's take a look at fitness centers. What are some substitutes for fitness centers? Well, you might have some equipment in your home, in your basement, like a treadmill. You might be on a diet plan. You may actually have something like the Nintendo Wii Fit to work out in your home. You may have an alternative at work where you can work out. You may go to a bar to meet people. It's another thing that happens in a fitness center. It's another service or another need that you could fulfill in other ways. There are many substitutes to the fitness center. Then Porter looked at the bargaining power of suppliers. Who is providing the key inputs and components for your product, for your firm? And do these suppliers have leverage over you? Do they have power? And can they extract some of the profits that you otherwise might make? He also looked at the bargaining power of the customer. Who are your customers? Who buys from you? Do they have leverage? Are they able to extract profits? Or do you have leverage over them? And finally, he looked at the rivalry among existing competitors. How intense is it? And in particular, do the firms in the industry compete hard on price? Do we see frequent price wars? Or do we see something that looks more like friendly competition, not quite so vicious, perhaps something where there's mutually beneficial work being done by competitors? These are the five forces then that shape strategy, that shape the profitability of an industry. You'd love to be in an industry where there's high barriers to entry, low power for suppliers and customers, where there aren't many alternatives, attractive substitutes, and where price wars are very infrequent or non-existent. So let's take a look at the airline industry again and see if we can apply this framework. Let's start with barriers to entry. At first glance, you might think it's very difficult to enter this business. It's got to be expensive and challenging. And yet, if you look over the past few decades, you see that many new players have entered this business. Therefore, we must conclude that the barriers cannot be so formidable. Why is it easy to enter the business, or at least moderately easy? Well, let's start with planes. Do you need to go out and buy new planes? You don't. You can lease old planes. And there are many of them available, because frankly, many companies are going bankrupt in this business every year. Pilots, the military trains them for you. And so you have people that you don't have to train from scratch. Airports, well, do you have to fight for a slot, an expensive one, at an airport like LAX or JFK in New York? You don't. You can go to smaller regional airports where states and counties are trying to draw traffic for economic development and tourism, and you can get access to a slot and start flying your planes. Barriers to entry are not so high. What about buyer power? Well, who are the buyers? The end users, the customers like you and me who fly? Well, we look at the product and we don't see much differentiation. Frankly, we aren't very loyal because there isn't really a difference between United and American, between any of the airlines that we look at. They look rather homogeneous. Moreover, there are travel sites like Expedia and Travelocity that offer us perfect price transparency. We can compare and look for the best bargain, and we often buy on price. We're highly price sensitive when it comes to air travel. Who are the suppliers and do they have power? Airbus and Boeing provide jumbo jets. A couple more players provide regional jets, but there aren't many alternatives when it comes to getting planes. As for labor, you've got to negotiate with powerful unions. And as for fuel, well, OPEC is a cartel that's going to drive the price of oil. So suppliers and buyers, they're powerful in this business. How about the threat of substitutes? Well, what do we have as substitutes for air travel? We certainly have other forms of transportation like the car and the train and other forms that we might use, but also we have things like video conferencing and the internet that provide us an alternative. So a business person doesn't have to go from New York to Shanghai on a plane. They might be able to get the work done in other ways using technology. And do they compete on price? Well, you betcha they do. There's not much differentiation. It's a homogeneous product. But there's also a very unique characteristic of the airline business that drives intense price competition. There are very high fixed costs in this business and virtually no variable or marginal costs. What do I mean by that? Well, what's the incremental expense to put you on a plane in that next seat that's vacant? It's virtually nothing. You might say it's peanuts, literally. As for the fixed costs, well, getting the plane in the sky, it's all fixed cost. There's very little expense that varies depending on how many passengers are on the plane. Well, what happens when you have high fixed costs and virtually no variable costs? Well, anything the airline receives above zero is what we call contribution margin. It's dollars that could go toward covering those fixed expenses, and if we cover them all, could go toward profitability. So there's an intense price competition to try to fill the seats. Moreover, the seats are perishable. That is to say, when that plane takes off, you can never sell that seat on that flight again. So you're dying to fill the plane to be able to be as profitable as possible, and it leads to price wars. It's a five-star terrible industry. The forces are all working to diminish profitability. So, you see that the framework can be powerful, but why do we need it in general? Why do we need such a conceptual understanding to help us plot strategy as a company? Well, the competitive environment, it's really complex and messy. And I think managers find it helpful to use this type of framework to examine their competitive environment in a systematic fashion. Now, like all frameworks, this one is a simplified version of reality. It's not perfect. It's not even correct in any sense, but it's very useful. As Milton Friedman said about any theory or conceptual framework, the question really isn't whether it's right. The question is, can it be useful to people so they can understand the world around them and make better decisions? And the five forces can definitely help us do that. So one key thing to remember about this framework, though, that it's useful not just to help us understand why some industries are profitable and others are not. We can use the framework to help us with other key strategic choices. Do I want to enter a particular market? Do I want to launch a venture? Or perhaps as an established company, move into an adjacent market? Do I want to exit? Might I want to get out of this business? Understanding the five forces and the attractiveness of that industry helps us with the entry and exit decision. What if consumer tastes or technology or government regulation are changing in a substantial way? Can I use the five forces to understand the impact on my profitability moving forward? You also can use the framework to think about how you might position your company to deal with some of the real threats that you face. How can you find a segment within what might be a really tough industry where a segment perhaps is a little more profitable and you might be able to thrive, whereas in the industry as a whole, many are losing money? And finally, you might be able to think about how you as a leading company in the industry might shape a more favorable industry structure. Can you do some things that perhaps raise barriers to entry and lift all boats, not just increase your profitability, but make the environment better for all? Now, where did this framework come from? As I say, Michael Porter first wrote about this in the 1970s. He was trained as an economist, but he was working at Harvard Business School, training managers who were going to go out and launch careers in the workplace. Now, economists typically begin by examining the behavior of firms in the economy by building models of what they call perfect competition. Now, there are certain assumptions that are embedded in these models of perfect competition. Here are those assumptions. Free entry and exit. It's easy to get in and out of the business. There are many buyers and sellers, and they're all relatively small and equal in size. There's complete information about the goods and services, the costs of producing them and delivering them. The goods themselves, they're homogeneous. They're relatively undifferentiated. And each firm is trying to maximize profits. What's the result of this perfect competition? Economists argue that this leads to maximum social welfare, and that's why they always start with this model of how the world works. What's the profit level for companies in that world, though? Well, economic profits equal zero. Now, this is not to say that firms make no accounting profits. What's the difference between accounting profits and economic profit? Well, accounting profits do not include opportunity costs for the labor and the capital that are deployed in a firm. Economic profits also account for those opportunity costs. And when you do so, in a perfectly competitive world, economic profits equal zero in these fundamental economic models that have been built and used by economists for many decades. Now, economists who studied industrial organization in history, they tended to examine markets characterized by imperfect competition from the perspective of the consumer. They were looking for antitrust issues. Were there instances of imperfect competition where firms might be engaging in behavior that harms consumers, that diminishes social welfare? Now, Porter looked at markets and said, from the perspective of a company, though, you'd like to be in a business where imperfect competition exists. You don't want economic profits to be zero. You want high earnings. Now, you don't want to create antitrust concerns. So you'd like to be imperfect, but not so imperfect that the government sues you. So what he did is begin to turn the assumptions of perfect competition on their head. He said, as a CEO, you should be looking for businesses where there are barriers to entry and barriers to exit, where it's not easy to get in or out. You'd like your goods not to be homogeneous, but differentiated. And if you can find these imperfections or help shape them, you can drive economic profits higher and higher. And that's what you're looking for as you shape strategy. Now, of course, the decision or the framework we should be thinking about is not one of perfect competition or monopoly. It's really a spectrum. At one end, we have many, many buyers and sellers, homogeneous goods, and no barriers to entry. At the other, we have one firm with 100% market share. Of course, there's things that are in between that. We have fragmented markets with many buyers and sellers, but they're not all tiny. But we also have something we call oligopoly. This is where you have three or four dominant players in an industry. And many of those industries, like chewing gum or carbonated soft drinks, we see some firms with significant market share, and we tend to see some high profits. So as we go through the course, we'll look at some oligopolies, and we'll try to understand how they operate. So what are the typical steps in this kind of a five forces analysis, analyzing an industry structure? First step, you have to define the industry that you wish to analyze. What do I mean by that? Well, suppose that you were working at Coca-Cola, and you wanted to analyze your industry, and you brought your management team together. You have to think about, well, what's the unit of analysis? Are we talking about carbonated soft drinks? All soft drinks? All beverages? There's no right answer there, but it's important that all of the members of the management team, they're all speaking the same language, that they're all focused on the same unit of analysis. Then you have to identify the players. Who are the buyers? Who are the suppliers? Who are our main rivals? Who are the substitutes? And it's important when you're looking at something like buyers that you think about all the buyers, not just the end user, but the distributor, the retailer, everyone along the supply chain with whom you interact. And then you're going to assess the strength of each force. Is buyer power high or low? Is supplier power high or low? But then you've got to look at the quantitative evidence. What do I mean by that? You have to look at the profitability of companies in the business. If you've done your five forces and concluded that things look great, but then you turn to the profitability of companies and you see very low margins, well, there's a fundamental disconnect there. You haven't done an appropriate analysis. You've got to look to the quantitative evidence and try to explain why you're seeing the profit margins that exist in your particular business. And lastly, you can't just look back. You've got to look forward. You have to understand the critical trends within your business. You don't want to just conclude that in the last 5 years, buyer power has been low. What you want to understand is, where will it be 5 years from now? And how can I project, based on my assessment of the environment, where these forces will be in the years ahead? So let's practice for a moment. Let's think about the pharmaceutical business, which historically has been very high profit. Are there barriers to entry? They're incredibly high. There's huge economies of scale. It's very expensive to get in this business. Just to develop one new drug can cost over $1 billion. There's strong intellectual property rights. You can patent your inventions and protect them against the competition. There are federal regulations that make it difficult to get a new drug on the market. there are formidable barriers to entry. What about the threat of substitutes? Well, think about that. What's the substitute to taking the prescription drug that your doctor has advised you to take? Surgery? Death? Homeopathic solutions? Not very attractive substitutes. How about the buyer? As an end user, do we have power? We don't. We don't even make the decision. The doctor makes the decision for us in many cases. And do we even know the price that we're paying? Most of us do not. We're paying a copayment when we go to the pharmacy to pick up our drug. We don't actually understand or know the underlying price. Suppliers, do they have any power? Well, who are the suppliers? They're companies that provide the compounds, right? The organic compounds that are then used and combined to create the prescription drug. But those are commodities. The real value lies with the companies, the pharma companies that actually combine those commodities using science to alleviate a particular condition, to provide us treatment. The products, the components themselves that they buy from suppliers, they're simply commodities. They can buy them from anyone. And lastly, is there intense rivalry in this business? Not at all. They don't compete on price as long as the patents are in effect. Once they are and they have intellectual property that they can defend, they don't have to compete on price. And the customer, after all, isn't shopping around on price at that point because they have few choices and insurance is covering a big chunk of the cost. So the pharma business is a wonderful business. The five forces look great. But contrast that with personal computers. So let's set Apple aside and look at what we call the Wintel world. The market for assembling and selling personal computers that operate off the Windows platform and largely off of Intel microprocessors. Are there barriers to entry in that business? What do you need to get into the business of assembling personal computers? Where did HP, Dell, and Apple start? HP and Apple started in a garage and Dell started in a dorm room in Texas. There couldn't have been formidable barriers to entry if they could start so easily. In fact, all you need is a screwdriver and you're in the business of assembling personal computers. The components are modular and you can buy them from anywhere. In fact, in emerging markets, white boxes, non-branded products account for a substantial share of the marketplace. There are low barriers to entry. Buyers, do we have power? It's a homogeneous product. If we're looking at Windows as the basic operating system for all these machines, can we even tell what brand of computer we're working on if we don't look for the logo? Suppliers, do they have power? Incredible. Not all of them, but two in particular, Microsoft and Intel. Because Microsoft dominates the operating system market, and Intel dominates the market for buying microprocessors. Substitutes, are they available? Tablets, smartphones, other forms of technology have begun to arise that are key substitutes for your laptop. And lastly, are there price wars in this business? You bet. They're intense. It's a homogeneous product. There isn't a lot of differentiation between Dell and HP. Moreover, the products become rapidly obsolete. Every year we have new models coming to market, and once the customer knows a new model is coming, their willingness to pay for existing models, it falls. And so what do retailers do? They begin to cut price. They're dying to get rid of that inventory before it becomes totally obsolete. So the personal computer business, despite high growth, actually looks quite unattractive from the perspective of the five forces. And in fact, Microsoft and Intel, over the last few decades, have made more money than the entire global personal computer business combined. So what's interesting about the five forces, as I mentioned earlier, is that it's not just a measure or a framework for helping us understand whether an industry is profitable or not. We can also use it to help us shape strategy. We can think about the negative forces in a business and ask ourselves, how can we craft a strategy that mitigates some of those negative forces? So let's think about Apple for a moment. If this industry is so unprofitable, and remember, yes, Dell has made quite a bit of money in this business, but think about all the personal computer businesses that have gone bankrupt over the years. So many brands that have gone by the wayside. It's been a tough business. But Apple, what have they done? How have they raised barriers to entry, reduced buyer and supplier power, cut rivalry, and mitigated the threat of substitutes? Well, they've built their own operating system. It costs $1 billion or more to do so. So it's expensive, it's hard for others to enter and compete directly with them. And their operating system fundamentally differentiates their product. It makes it easier for users to use an Apple product, and they've mitigated the power of Microsoft. They're not dependent on buying Windows, as the other PC makers are. They built their own stores. Why is that important? That's mitigated the power of the big box retail chains and other online retailers. So that's been key as well. And as for substitutes, well, Apple's been willing to cannibalize themselves, to build tablets, to build smartphones. They've gotten into the substitute business rather than letting others eat their lunch. The lesson? The framework's useful for thinking about how a firm can position itself well in a very tough industry and make money, which Apple has done. Are there some common mistakes we see as people use this framework? Well, I think sometimes we see managers applying this to their company, not realizing it's really a tool for understanding your industry, not your company. And we see management teams not defining the industry clearly when they begin to do their analysis. We also see people looking back and not looking forward and not trying to understand the trends, but spending too much time looking at what's happened before. And they ignore the full range of substitutes. So if you're in the fitness center business, they're not thinking about the bar down the street or necessarily thinking about diet plans or even surgery as alternatives to a fitness center. Thinking about the full range of substitutes is crucial if you want to sustain your advantage. We also can't pay equal attention to all the forces. 4 of the 5 can look great, but if barriers to entry are collapsing in your business, look out. You may see a real hit to your profit margins. This is not a simple linear addition of the 5, and you can say, check, 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 4 of these look great, I'm in good shape. 1 negative force can harm you. And finally, industry structure is not the same around the world, and some people presume that it is at times. What do I mean by that? Well, suppose you were going to analyze the wine business, that you were Gallo or another leading wine brand. Could you do an industry analysis of the wine business? Well, you'd have to be careful, because in Australia, several firms dominate the whole business. It's an oligopoly. In France, there are over 200,000 independent wineries, each of them very small. It's an incredibly fragmented market. So the industry has a fundamentally different structure in these two parts of the world. It's very hard to do 1-5 forces for the entire global industry. Now, the framework is not perfect. There are clearly limitations, and I want to talk about 5 of them. First, boundaries. As technology has changed and the world has changed, it's become more difficult to draw clear industry boundaries in many cases. We've seen industries converge. And so when you look at firms like Google and Amazon, it's not even clear what industries they compete with or who their rivals are, because they seem to be competing in many different spaces in different ways. Globalization is also an interesting issue. As we said, it's dangerous to apply the 5 forces on a global basis when, despite globalization, we see dramatic differences in markets around the world. How much of an impact does industry structure have on profitability? Some studies have shown that it has a big impact. Others, academics have argued, no, not as much of an impact. I think that academic debate misses a key point, which is managers are simply worried about, is this important and does it help shape competition and affect my margins? Exactly how much it affects profitability, that's less relevant to a manager. Rivalry. This framework provides limited tools and techniques for understanding the nature of rivalry. And I think the framework in its original conceptualization wasn't crystal clear on the differences between price rivalry and non-price competition. Price wars are really bad for profitability. Non-price competition, creative advertising campaigns and merchandising and retailers, well, that kind of competition can actually lift all boats. It can grow the overall market and build primary demand for your product. Coke and Pepsi were rivals, but they didn't get into price wars in the 20th century. They engaged in non-price competition that actually increased the market for soft drinks overall and was beneficial to both parties. And finally, there's the issue of complements. Industry analysis in its original form did not explicitly address the nature and the importance of complements. What's a complement? Some have called it the 6th force that needs to be considered. A complement is a product or service that adds value to the original product offering when the two are used together. Peanut butter and jelly. Computer hardware and software. Adam Brandenburger is one of the first scholars who began to point to the importance of complements. And why did he think this was crucial for helping us understand our competitive environment? Well, he coined the term co-optition. He said there are instances, many of them, when competitors are also cooperating to achieve strategic objectives. And this can be quite tricky. When you have someone who's both your rival and someone who's producing a complement to your product. Samsung and Google. Samsung makes the phone, and Google makes the Android operating system. But Google's also competing directly with Samsung in the phone market at times. So you have this interesting dynamic of the rival and the complementer being one and the same. When it comes to complements, it's really important to understand the business model and how it works. So let's take razors and blades, two complements. Gillette pioneered this model. How do they make money? Gillette's not making money off the razor. They want to get that razor into your hands, even if it costs them money to get it into your hands. Why? Because if you like the razor, you'll be buying blades forever. And you're buying pretty expensive blades, and they're making a lot of money. What's interesting, of course, is we have another firm that sort of flipped that business model on its head. In Apple's case, they went to a blades and razor strategy when they entered the iPod and the smartphone and the iPad market. Blades and razors. What do I mean by that? Well, how do you get someone to pay $400 for a smartphone? I mean, before the Apple iPhone, were you and I paying for a phone? A few dollars, often nothing. How do you go from that to $400? Well, how do you get someone to buy really expensive peanut butter? You give them a lot of really cheap jelly. And that's what Steve Jobs did. He gave us 99-cent songs on iTunes. He gave us a lot of free apps. And by doing that, all that cheap, really cool, tasty jelly, we went out and bought really expensive peanut butter. We called it the iPhone for $400 or the iPad. Razors and blades? No, blades and razors at Apple. So what are some of the lessons that surprise us from this lecture and thinking about industry and the structure that differs across industries? Number one, sexy industries are not necessarily the high profit industries. Airlines have also always been something featured in films, and they've attracted macho entrepreneurs who want to enter and be in the skies and dominate the business. Fitness centers have been a, quote, sexy business in that we've seen a drive to reduce obesity and to try to get more fit. It's been a growing phenomenon in the United States and other countries. Yet these industries, which look like they're attractive, haven't generated much profit. Moreover, the second lesson that surprises is high growth doesn't equal high profits. Personal computers grew dramatically in the 80s and 90s, but didn't generate a lot of earnings. The third lesson is that stable, relatively low growth industries can be very profitable. Who knows much about the industrial gas market, yet it's been a wildly profitable business for many years. And our final lesson is that with the appropriate competitive positioning, firms can mitigate negative forces and make healthy earnings even in a tough industry. It's difficult to do, but some have done it. So, what's your assignment? We want you to practice the five forces. We want you to think about the analysis for the fitness center industry. It's a low profit business. Go through the five forces on your own. Why is that business so low in profitability for many firms? And then compare it to the chewing gum industry. Chewing gum has made a lot of money in recent years. It's an oligopoly. There are a few players that dominate the business. Take a look at it, go through the five forces, and try to understand why is that such a high profit business.
This lecture is titled, The Danger of Straddling.
What's different about the competitive strategies of these three firms? Dell, Mercedes, and JCPenney. Well, Dell, they're trying to be the low-cost player in the personal computer market. Mercedes, a very different strategy. Mercedes offering luxury automobiles. They're trying to be a differentiated player. They have a high premium price, and they're proud of it. They're selling you a luxury product and asking you to pay a price commensurate with the quality that they offer. And then what about JCPenney? Where do they stand? A little more difficult to understand precisely what that strategy is all about. They are stuck in the middle, neither successfully achieving that low-cost strategy like Dell or Walmart, nor successfully achieving a differentiation strategy like Mercedes or Apple. Strategy is all about understanding your competitive environment and then positioning yourself for success in that environment. Now, we looked in the last lecture about understanding your environment by doing the five forces. Now we try to understand what is it about the resources and the capabilities that you build as a firm that enable you to succeed in that environment. How do you position yourself in that environment? Robert Grant wrote that strategy is concerned with matching a firm's resources and capabilities to the opportunities that arise in the external environment. As you do this, as you plot your strategy and try to position yourself, you're trying to create a competitive advantage relative to your rivals. To do that, you have to create more economic value than your rivals. What does it mean to create economic value? Well, when you produce a good or service and sell it, there's a certain perceived value for that good and service. Customers have some perception of what they're willing to pay for that product. There's also the cost, of course, for you to deliver that product or service to them. What is the cost of producing, distributing, and selling that item? The perceived value, less the total cost, equals the economic value created. Of course, you as the company that provides that good, you don't get all of that economic value created. That value is then split between you and your consumer. For the consumer, anything that they pay that's less than what they're willing to pay, less than what they perceive as the value for that good, well, that's surplus to them. That's part of the economic value that they get. For you as the company, any price or any revenue that you can achieve higher than the cost of producing and delivering that good, that's the surplus. That's the profit for you. And your goal as a firm is to generate more economic value than your competition. That's what we mean by achieving competitive advantage. Now, in terms of competitive positioning, there are two real questions that you have to ask yourself as you plot your strategy. First, what type of advantage do I seek? What type of competitive advantage am I trying to achieve as I look at my strategy relative to my competitors? And there really are three types of competitive advantage that you can strive to achieve. First, you can try to be the low-cost player, like TJ Maxx or Dell. Or you could be a differentiated player, like Mercedes. And finally, you may try to achieve what's called dual advantage, having very low costs and somehow achieving a premium price. A rather difficult task that we'll look at in a moment, but it is a possibility at least in terms